Okay, let's unpack this. In the demanding, ever-evolving world of healthcare, you, as a nursing student, are constantly learning, constantly absorbing. But the real challenge isn't just taking in information, it's cutting through the noise, finding those critical insights, those aha moments that genuinely prepare you for practice. Especially when we're talking about something as prevalent and impactful as anxiety and insomnia. These aren't abstract concepts, they're daily realities for countless patients you will encounter. That's precisely our mission today. We're embarking on a deep dive into the pharmacology of anxiety and insomnia, with a specific focus on benzodiazepines. We've gathered some comprehensive sources for you, study guides, instructor notes, and lecture overviews, all curated to give you a shortcut to being not just informed, but well-informed. Our goal is to extract the most important nuggets of knowledge, the core insights, so you understand not just the what of these crucial medications, but the why they work the way they do and the how you, as a future nurse, will safely and effectively manage them.
And this deep dive is particularly vital because, look, nurses will encounter these drugs with remarkable frequency, almost every clinical setting. Understanding their nuances isn't just about passing an exam. It's absolutely critical for ensuring patient safety, delivering effective care, and practicing with confidence. This exploration will equip you with a foundational understanding of anxiolytics and hypnotics. Specifically, benzodiazepines, their mechanisms, their journey through the body, and the crucial considerations for safe and compassionate patient care. It's about building a robust framework for your clinical judgment.
Okay, so let's start right there. We're talking about drugs designed to help with two very common, often intertwined conditions, anxiety and sleep disturbances. But let's clarify right off the bat. What's the primary distinction between an anxiolytic and a hypnotic? Are they essentially two sides of the same therapeutic coin, or is there a fundamental difference in their intended action?
That's a fundamental question, yeah. It's where we lay the groundwork. While they often overlap in effect, their primary therapeutic goals are distinct. Anxiolytics, literally meaning anxiety-breaking, are primarily aimed at promoting relaxation and reducing that subjective feeling of anxiety. They help to calm an overactive nervous system, easing worry, tension, the physical symptoms of unease.
Right, easing the tension.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Hypnotics, on the other hand, are specifically formulated to produce and sustain sleep. Their main purpose is to help a patient initiate sleep more quickly or maintain it throughout the night. However, what unites them, and what's absolutely crucial for you to remember, is that both categories fall under the umbrella of central nervous system, or CNS, depressants.
Ah, okay. Both CNS depressants.
Correct. This means they both exert their effects by slowing down brain activity. Because of this shared fundamental mechanism, they often exhibit similar pharmacological actions. A drug prescribed primarily as an anxiolytic, for instance, a benzodiazepine given for generalized anxiety, will almost certainly have sedative properties, potentially making a patient drowsy. Conversely, a hypnotic designed to induce sleep will undoubtedly have anxiolytic effects by virtue of calming the brain. This overlap means you, as a nurse, must always consider the full spectrum of effects, not just the primary indication, when assessing and educating your patients.
Okay, so the underlying CNS depressant action is the common denominator, and this overlap means nurses are always considering the full spectrum of effects. Not just why it was prescribed, it really highlights why understanding specific drug profiles beyond just their class is so vital. You can't just assume a drug only does one thing.
Absolutely. Think of it this way. A lower dose might produce an anxiolytic effect, while a slightly higher dose of the same drug might induce hypnosis. For example, a patient might be prescribed a benzodiazepine for acute anxiety, and you observe them becoming quite sedated. This isn't necessarily an unexpected side effect. It's often an anticipated outcome of its CNS depressant nature, particularly at higher doses or with a specific drug known for its potent sedative properties. Your job is to discern if that level of sedation is therapeutic, like calming a severely agitated patient, or if it's excessive and potentially an adverse event, indicating a need for dose adjustment or further monitoring. That critical distinction is a constant part of your nursing assessment.
Okay, that makes sense. Now, shifting gears a bit, our sources present a really intriguing, maybe even counterintuitive perspective on anxiety. We often see it purely as something negative, something to be fixed. But what do our materials tell us about its potentially beneficial side? Can anxiety actually be constructive?
That's a truly insightful question. And yeah, our sources definitely offer a more nuanced view than just anxiety is bad. Yes, anxiety in its situational form can absolutely be beneficial. It's a normal, healthy, and ancient response to stress, serving a vital adaptive purpose. Think of it as your brain's natural alert system.
Like a warning signal.
Exactly. When you're facing a significant exam, prepping for a clinical rotation, or about to present a care plan, a certain level of anxiety can sharpen your focus, motivate you to study harder, push you to prepare more thoroughly. It's that physiological and psychological activation that helps us cope and problem solve. And what's truly insightful here, and often overlooked, is that beyond just being an alert system, experiencing and learning to cope with normal, situational anxiety is crucial for developing resilience.
Mm-hmm. Building coping skills.
Right. It's not just about managing the feeling, but allowing it to serve its adaptive purpose, building your capacity to handle future stressors. The key distinction, which is critical for you as nurses, is that this normal situational anxiety is temporary. It typically resolves once the stressor is gone, or once you've successfully navigated the challenge, and it doesn't significantly interfere with your daily life or overall functioning.
So it's like a finely tuned warning system that can aid growth, but sometimes it goes haywire, gets stuck on. How do we, as healthcare providers, tell the difference between this beneficial transient anxiety and an anxiety disorder that genuinely requires intervention?
Exactly. That's the crux of it. The problem, and the point where intervention becomes necessary, arises when anxiety escalates into an anxiety disorder. This is when the anxiety becomes chronic, persistent, often disproportionate to the actual threat, and most importantly, it significantly interferes with daily activities, relationships, and overall functioning.
So it impacts their life in a major way.
A major way. It might manifest as debilitating panic attacks, constant uncontrollable worry, specific phobias that prevent normal activities, or an inability to sleep night after night, leading to exhaustion and further distress. For you as a nursing student, understanding this distinction is absolutely foundational. It directly informs your assessment. You're not just asking, are you anxious? You're looking for the duration, the intensity, the pervasiveness, and the impact on the patient's daily life.
Got it. So it's a much deeper assessment.
Much deeper. This helps you determine when a patient might simply need reassurance, stress management techniques, or coping strategies for a normal life event, versus when they truly need a pharmacological intervention for a diagnosable clinical disorder. This critical thinking prevents unnecessary medication use and ensures that the care provided is appropriate, targeted, and truly beneficial for the patient's actual needs. It's about empowering patients to cope where possible and intervening appropriately when necessary. Stepping back now and connecting this to the broader clinical landscape, benzodiazepines are undeniably a major player in managing these conditions once intervention is deemed necessary. Let's get a high-level view of this significant drug class. Benzodiazepines are a well-established class of CNS depressant drugs, often considered a workhorse in managing anxiety, insomnia, seizures, and other conditions we'll explore. One of their most notable characteristics, which is a vital safety consideration for you, is their relatively wide margin of safety between therapeutic and toxic doses.
Okay, a wide safety margin, that sounds good.
It is, comparatively speaking. It means it generally takes a significantly higher dose than the therapeutic one to cause severe harm. Our sources even state that they are rarely fatal when taken alone orally, even an overdose. Though we must never minimize the fact that severe toxicity can and does still have very serious and life-threatening manifestations, especially when combined with other substances.
Right. So they're generally considered safer in terms of immediate isolated overdose risks compared to some older CNS depressants like barbiturates, maybe. But that doesn't mean they're without any risk, especially with their potential for dependence and interactions. Right?
Precisely. That wide safety margin is a significant advantage, particularly compared to drugs like barbiturates, which have a much narrower therapeutic window.
Yeah.
But it absolutely does not mean they are benign. Their toxicity, especially when combined with other CNS depressants, alcohol, opioids can lead to severe issues like profound sedation, dangerous respiratory depression, and even coma. This is why meticulous monitoring is essential. Furthermore, benzodiazepines are classified as Schedule 4 drugs under the Controlled Substances Act.
Schedule 4. What does that signify exactly?
That classification indicates they have a relatively low potential for abuse and dependence compared to Schedule 1 or 3 drugs. However, low potential should never be interpreted as no potential. You must recognize that physiological dependence can and does still occur, particularly with prolonged high-dose use, necessitating careful management and patient education.
That's a critical point for nurses to grasp. Despite that wide safety margin, careful monitoring and strict adherence to guidelines are paramount due to their potential for dependence and, as we'll discuss, their critical interactions. It's not a free pass for casual use.
Absolutely not. A wide safety margin provides a buffer, but it doesn't negate the need for vigilance. As a nurse, you play a crucial role in observing for subtle signs of oversedation, monitoring respiratory status, and over time, assessing for potential signs of physiological dependence. You're also central to educating patients about the profound importance of taking the medication exactly as prescribed, never increasing the dose independently, and never abruptly discontinuing it, which can precipitate severe withdrawal symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
Your understanding of their Schedule 4 classification also helps you grasp the regulatory controls around these medications, which reflect their inherent risks and the necessity for careful handling, secure storage, and thorough patient counseling. This knowledge is not theoretical. It directly informs your daily practice in ensuring patient safety.
Okay, so if these drugs are essentially pressing the brain's calm button, the next step is understanding how they do that. How do benzodiazepines actually work their magic in the brain? Our sources pinpoint a specific neurotransmitter as the absolute key player here.
Right. Delving deeper into this, their precise interaction with the brain's natural calming system is really the key. And the absolute star player, as our sources highlight, is gamma-aminobutyric acid, universally known as GABA.
GABA.
GABA is the primary inhibitory neurotransmitter in the brain. Think of it quite literally as the brain's natural brake pedal.
The brake pedal. I like that analogy.
Yeah, it helps visualize it. When GABA is released, it binds to its receptors on nerve cells, which then opens chloride channels. This influx of chloride ions makes the nerve cell less likely to fire, reducing nerve transmission and neuronal excitability. Essentially, it slows down overall brain activity, leading to a calming effect. Now, here's the truly insightful part and a critical distinction for you. Benzodiazepines don't replace GABA, nor do they directly activate the GABA receptors on their own.
Okay, so they don't mimic GABA directly.
No, they don't. Instead, they enhance the inhibitory effect of GABA. They act as allosteric modulators.
Allosteric modulators. What does that mean in simpler terms?
It means they bind to a specific benzodiazepine receptor site on the GABA-I receptor complex, which is separate from where GABA itself binds. When a benzodiazepine binds there, it changes the shape of the GABA receptor in a way that makes GABA more efficient at binding and opening those chloride channels.
Ah, so it makes GABA better at its job.
Precisely. It amplifies GABA's natural calming effect, allowing chloride to enter the cell more readily when GABA is present.
So it's like GABA is already pushing the brake, and benzodiazepines just make that brake pedal much more responsive, making it more effective at slowing things down, but only if GABA is already there to do the initial pushing. That sounds like a crucial difference, especially compared to some older medications, isn't it?
That's a perfect analogy, and you've hit on a critical safety point. By intensifying GABA's action, benzodiazepines decrease neuronal excitability across various brain regions. This widespread slowing down leads directly to their multiple therapeutic results: reduced anxiety, promoting sleep, and also their effectiveness as anticonvulsants, calming overactive electrical activity and as muscle relaxants by dampening nerve signals to muscles. And to expand on your excellent point about older medications, this mechanism inherently provides a kind of ceiling to their depressant effects. Unlike older CNS depressants, like barbiturates, which could directly open the GABA channel even without GABA present.
Uh-huh. So barbiturates could just slam the brakes on their own.
Essentially, yes, which led to a much higher risk of profound irreversible respiratory depression and coma. Benzodiazepines, by only enhancing GABA, are less likely to cause that level of severe dose-dependent respiratory depression and overdose when taken alone. This ceiling effect is a vital safety net in clinical practice and a key insight into why they superseded barbiturates for many indications.
That makes a lot of sense.
Understanding this mechanism is incredibly powerful for you as a nursing student because it helps you anticipate all the therapeutic effects a patient might experience beyond just anxiety relief, as well as potential side effects like sedation or dizziness. It also empowers you to explain to patients why they're feeling calmer or drowsier, which builds trust and improves adherence. Okay, so once a patient has taken a benzodiazepine, how does this powerful modulator of brain activity make its way through the body, exert its effects, and then get eliminated? This drug journey, or pharmacokinetics, is absolutely vital for you to grasp, especially when considering dosing, monitoring, and patient-specific factors.
Right, because how it gets into the system, distributes itself, gets processed, and eventually leaves the body dramatically impacts not only its efficacy, but also its potential for side effects and how we manage a patient's response. It's not just about the brain target.
Exactly. Let's break down this journey. First, administration and absorption. Benzodiazepines can be given orally, PO, intravenously, or intramuscularly, IM. Most are very well and rapidly absorbed when taken orally, making PO common for outpatient use. Some, like midazolam, are specifically designed for rapid onset via IV for pre-procedural sedation. Once absorbed, they distribute throughout the body and, crucially, cross the blood-brain barrier to reach their target receptors in the CNS. The next critical state is metabolism. Benzodiazepines are primarily metabolized in the liver, often involving the cytochrome P450 CYP enzyme system, particularly CYP3A4.
Oh, liver. Okay, that sounds like a really important checkpoint.
It is. This is a paramount point for your patient assessment. If a patient has impaired liver function, perhaps due to liver disease, alcoholism, or even advanced age where liver function naturally declines, the drug will be metabolized more slowly. This can lead to its accumulation in the body, prolonging its effects, and significantly increasing the risk of adverse effects, such as excessive sedation, confusion, and respiratory depression. You'll often see specific caution or dose reductions recommended for patients with hepatic impairment.
So liver function tests become absolutely non-negotiable for these patients then to assess their ability to process the medication safely. And what about the concept of active metabolites? I remember hearing about those.
Absolutely. Assessing liver function, often through LFTs, is paramount before and during therapy, particularly for long-term use or in vulnerable populations. Yeah. And you bring up a crucial point about active metabolites. Many benzodiazepines are metabolized into compounds that are themselves pharmacologically active, meaning they continue to exert the drug's effects.
So the breakdown products are still active?
Yes, some of them. For example, diazepam, Valium, is metabolized into desmethyldiazepam, which also has a long half-life and contributes significantly to the drug's prolonged effects and potential for accumulation. This is particularly relevant in older adults, where these active metabolites can accumulate to toxic levels. Following metabolism, the resulting inactive, or sometimes active metabolites, are primarily excreted through the kidneys.
Okay, kidneys handle the exit strategy.
Right. Similar to the liver, if a patient has impaired kidney function, these metabolites might not be cleared effectively. Again, this leads to accumulation and potential toxicity. So renal function also needs careful consideration, often assessed through BUN and creatinine levels. Finally, the drug's half-life is a cornerstone of its pharmacokinetic profile. This is the time it takes for the concentration of a drug in the body to be reduced by half.
Half-life. Right, that affects dosing frequency and accumulation, doesn't it?
Absolutely. It directly dictates how often a drug needs to be given, how long its effects will last, and whether it might accumulate with repeated dosing. Benzodiazepines vary widely in their half-lives, which has significant clinical implications. For example, diazepam, Valium, has a notably long half-life, ranging from 20 to 80 hours, and its active metabolites can extend this even further.
Wow, 20 to 80 hours is a long time.
It is. It means it stays in the system for a considerable time, which can be beneficial for sustained anxiolysis, like an alcohol withdrawal, but also significantly increases the risk of accumulation, prolonged sedation, and next-day grogginess, especially with repeated doses or in patients with compromised liver or kidney function.
So a long half-life means potentially sustained therapeutic effects, but also a higher risk of residual effects like next-day sedation or cognitive impairment, especially in older adults. And what about shorter-acting ones? Are they better for sleep, maybe?
Precisely. Long-acting benzos like diazepam are often chosen for chronic anxiety or alcohol withdrawal, where the sustained effect is desired. But for insomnia, a long half-life could mean significant hangover effects, impairing driving or daily tasks. This is where shorter-acting benzodiazepines might be preferred for insomnia due to quicker elimination and less next-day sedation. However, their shorter half-life can also mean a more abrupt return of anxiety if not managed carefully, and potentially a higher risk of dependence and withdrawal if used indiscriminately. Patients might be tempted to take them more frequently.
Right, so it's a trade-off. It really depends on the clinical goal.
Always a trade-off.
So for you as nurses, this intricate pharmacokinetic profile absorption, liver metabolism, kidney excretion, half-life, active metabolites, it directly influences how you administer, monitor, and adjust dosages, particularly in special populations. You're not just giving a pill. You're managing a complex biological process.
You've encapsulated it perfectly. Knowing these details helps you understand why you might need a lower dose for an elderly patient or someone with liver disease, or why some meds are given more often than others. It informs your monitoring for oversedation or toxicity checking, respiratory rate, consciousness, coordination, and it allows you to provide clear, accurate patient education about timing, side effects, adherence, empowering them, and fostering safer outcomes. This holistic view is fundamental to your role.
Okay, building on that understanding of how they work and travel through the body, it's truly fascinating to see the versatility of benzodiazepines. While we're deep diving into anxiety and insomnia, they clearly aren't just for calming nerves or inducing sleep, are they?
That's right. If we connect this to the broader applications, their mechanism of enhancing GABA gives them a far wider range of uses. While anxiolytic and hypnotic are primary, their broad CNS impact makes them incredibly useful elsewhere. Beyond those, they are also highly effective as anticonvulsants. Their ability to suppress excessive neuronal excitability makes them a go-to for various seizures, including status epilepticus, a medical emergency. That stems directly from their CNS depressant action.
Okay, anticonvulsants too. What else?
Well, they also play a crucial role in preoperative sedation. For patients facing surgery or procedures, drugs like midazolam or Verst are frequently used. They provide powerful anxiolysis, reducing anxiety, and also offer anterograde amnesia. The patient often won't remember the procedure itself, much less traumatic.
Yeah, I can certainly see how that anxiolysis and amnesia would be an incredible benefit, not just for the patient's comfort, but probably for the surgical team too. A calmer patient helps everyone.
Absolutely. Another critical, even life-saving application is their use in preventing agitation and delirium tremens, DTs, in acute alcohol withdrawal.
Ah, alcohol withdrawal, that can be really dangerous.
Yeah. Extremely. It involves profound CNS hyperexcitability tremors, agitation, hallucinations, potentially seizures, or DTs. DTs are the most severe form. Confusion, vivid hallucinations, severe agitation, rapid heart rate, potentially fatal. Benzodiazepines, by restoring some CNS depression, help stabilize that overactive nervous system, preventing dangerous symptoms, making withdrawal safer. Furthermore, they're often used concurrently with other psychotropics, antidepressants, antipsychotics, mood stabilizers. They can treat acute anxiety symptoms associated with depression, psychosis, or mania.
Kind of like a bridge.
Exactly. Often a bridging effect. While the primary meds take weeks to work fully, benzos provide rapid relief for anxiety, agitation, or insomnia, helping stabilize the patient initially. They're not a long-term fix for the underlying condition, but an invaluable adjunct for acute symptoms.
And our sources specifically highlight diazepam or Valium as being a particularly versatile prototype that embodies many of these uses. It seems to do almost all of these things.
That's right. Diazepam is a classic prototype, a shining example of this versatility. It's indicated for all the uses we just discussed: anti-anxiety, hypnotic, anticonvulsant, pre-op sedation, and managing acute alcohol withdrawal, including DTs. But it has the distinct advantage of also being highly effective as a muscle relaxant, useful for muscle spasms and tension, again, thanks to its broad CNS depressant effects. This extensive list truly underscores why understanding benzodiazepines, and particularly a prototype like diazepam, is so significant for you. It's a tool with many facets, each needing precise application. Now, given this power and versatility, this leads us to a crucial consideration. How do we ensure patient safety and optimize efficacy? Our sources strongly emphasize that the art of dosing is fundamentally about individualization and careful titration.
No one-size-fits-all dose.
Definitely not. It must be tailored to each unique patient. The rationale is clear. Relieve symptoms effectively while meticulously avoiding adverse effects and maintaining that wide safety margin. It's a delicate balancing act.
So it's not a static prescription. It's a dynamic process of finding that therapeutic sweet spot enough to work, but not too much to cause harm. That sounds like a significant nursing responsibility, keeping track of that balance.
Exactly. It's constant assessment and adjustment. A cornerstone principle here is giving them, for the shortest period, effective. This is paramount for minimizing risks like physiological dependence and withdrawal. For anxiolytic use, the guideline is start low, smallest dose likely to be effective. Then adjust upward gradually based on response to relieve symptoms, all while carefully monitoring for adverse effects like sedation or poor coordination. Ideally, our sources suggest anxiolytic use shouldn't exceed 4 months. Longer than that significantly ups the risk of dependence and tougher withdrawal.
4 months seems like a very specific cutoff for anxiety use. What about when they're primarily used for sleep as hypnotics? Are the guidelines even stricter there? Because sleep issues can become chronic quickly.
They are indeed stricter. For hypnotic use, the guidelines are even more stringent due to the rapid development of tolerance and dependence with daily sleep use. The directive is lowest effective dose and crucially take it intermittently. Our sources specify not more than 3 to 4 nights per week and generally for a maximum of 3 weeks.
Wow, only 3 to 4 nights a week, max 3 weeks. That's really short term.
It is. This intermittent short-term approach for sleep minimizes dependence risk and helps maintain efficacy by preventing tolerance where the drug just stops working as well over time. Now, beyond these general rules, we must always consider special considerations for dosing in specific populations. Older adults are a prime example. They metabolize benzodiazepines more slowly due to age-related changes like decreased liver mass, reduced blood flow, diminished enzyme activity.
Right, we touched on that with metabolism.
Exactly. This significantly increases their risk for accumulation of the drug and its active metabolites, particularly with longer-acting ones. This accumulation leads to excessive sedative effects, confusion, impaired balance, unsteadiness, dramatically increased risk of falls.
Falls are a huge concern in the elderly.
Huge. This necessitates extreme caution, careful dosage adjustment, often starting with half the usual adult dose or even less, and continuous monitoring for adverse effects. Many benzos, especially long-acting ones, are on the Beers criteria list of potentially inappropriate meds for older adults.
So a dose that's perfectly safe for a younger adult could be dangerously high for an older patient, potentially leading to devastating falls. It really emphasizes that individualized care.
Precisely. And conversely, patients who are severely anxious or acutely agitated might actually need larger than usual doses initially to stabilize them, say, in an ER setting for panic. But even then, careful titration is still key to manage symptoms safely without over-sedating. A particularly critical consideration, one with major regulatory warnings, is concurrent use with opioid analgesics.
Ah, yes, the opioid combination. Very dangerous, right?
Extremely dangerous. Both are potent CNS depressants. Combined use significantly increases the risk of excessive CNS depression, leading to severe respiratory depression, coma, even death. If they must be used together, the opioid dose should be initially reduced, maybe 25-50%, then gradually increased only as needed, while meticulously monitoring respiratory status.
These guidelines aren't just suggestions. They're non-negotiable for safe medication administration and patient advocacy, especially for you as a nursing student. This is where your critical thinking and assessment skills become absolutely vital.
They are indeed the backbone of safe practice. Your thorough understanding and diligent application of these guidelines are central to protecting patients, optimizing outcomes, and providing truly patient-centered care. You'll be the one at the bedside, giving the med, monitoring response, assessing for side effects, educating them. This comprehensive knowledge is fundamental to your professional responsibility and advocacy.
Okay, now let's talk about some of those risks head-on. We often hear about the significant risks of withdrawal with certain medications, and benzodiazepines are certainly no exception. What do our sources tell us about what a patient might experience during withdrawal, and crucially, how can we as nurses help prevent severe reactions?
Right. Delving deeper into this, what's compelling is the spectrum of withdrawal. It's not all or nothing. Our sources indicate that even mild withdrawal symptoms can occur in about half of patients taking the med for just 6 to 12 weeks.
Half. Even after only 6 weeks, what kind of mild symptoms?
Yeah, it can be relatively subtle but distressing things like increased anxiety, rebound insomnia, their sleep gets worse again, irritability, restlessness, maybe a fine tremor. These, while uncomfortable, are often manageable with careful tapering. However, the situation gets much more serious with severe withdrawal symptoms. These are far more likely when the medication's been taken in high doses, often for more than 4 months, and then stopped abruptly.
So going cold turkey after long-term high-dose use is really what we're trying to avoid at all costs. That sounds dangerous.
It is the danger zone. Severe withdrawal can manifest as profound, potentially life-threatening symptoms. Seizures, vivid hallucinations, severe tremors, intense debilitating anxiety and panic attacks, even psychosis. It's a very serious medical condition requiring immediate intervention and can be fatal.
That really highlights the critical importance of a gradual reduction then. Abrupt cessation is just off the table.
Exactly. This is precisely why gradual tapering of the dosage is absolutely essential. Benzodiazepines, with prolonged use, cause physiological dependence. The body adapts to the drug's presence. When it's removed too quickly, the brain, which has downregulated its own natural GABA calming systems, suddenly loses that external boost, leading to an overactive, hyperexcitable state.
So the brain kind of goes into overdrive.
Precisely. This physiological dependence makes careful, slow tapering indispensable. The schedule needs to be individualized, often over weeks or even months, depending on the dose, duration, and specific benzo used. As a nurse, your role here is critical. You monitor for withdrawal symptoms, mild and severe, and also for the recurrence of the original symptoms, the anxiety, the insomnia after discontinuation. If symptoms return too quickly or intensely, the taper might be too fast, or the patient needs more support, coping strategies, therapy, other non-drug interventions.
And patient education is key here too, I imagine.
Vital. Thorough patient education on the absolute necessity of tapering and never stopping abruptly is crucial. You are key in guiding patients safely through this transition. Now, while benzodiazepines have that wide safety margin we discussed, toxicity is still a serious concern, especially with misuse, excessive doses, or most commonly, combination with other CNS depressants. For you as a nurse, recognizing the red flags of toxicity and knowing the immediate intervention is a critical life-saving skill.
What are those key red flags we should be looking for?
The key symptoms are a direct, exaggerated extension of their CNS depressant effects. So, excessive sedation, progressing beyond drowsiness to unresponsiveness, stupor, or coma. More alarmingly, severe respiratory depression breathing becomes dangerously slow and shallow, potentially leading to low oxygen and respiratory arrest. And ultimately, in severe cases, coma.
And I distinctly remember reading about a paradoxical effect in children, which seems incredibly important for pediatric nurses to recognize, as it completely defies the expected sedating effect. It sounds confusing.
Yes, that's an absolutely crucial detail for pediatric nursing, easily missed if you're unaware. In children, instead of sedation, benzotoxicity may paradoxically cause agitation, excitement, or hyperactivity.
The opposite of what you'd expect.
Exactly. It can be incredibly misleading. But the most critical piece of information for any nurse regarding benzotoxicity is knowing the specific antidote. Flumazenil, brand names Romazicon or Masicon.
Flumazenil. Okay, the antidote. How does it work?
Flumazenil is a benzodiazepine receptor antagonist. It specifically reverses the CNS depressant effects of benzotoxicity. It works by competitively binding to the benzoreceptors in the brain, essentially kicking benzodiazepine off its binding site, reversing its effects rapidly.
So knowing this antidote and being proficient in its administration isn't just useful, it's a critical life-saving skill, especially in emergency and critical care settings. Like, you have to know this.
Absolutely. Imagine an ER or ICU scenario. Patient arrives unconscious, shallow breathing, benzo overdose suspected. Your quick assessment, recognizing the signs, and prompt precise administration of Flumazenil can literally be the difference between life and death. You need to be ready to give it rapidly, understand its action, and importantly, monitor closely for rebound sedation.
Rebound sedation, why does that happen?
Because Flumazenil often has a shorter half-life, maybe around an hour, than many of the benzos it's reversing. So its effects can wear off before the benzo is fully eliminated, meaning the sedation can return. This necessitates continuous vigilance and sometimes repeated dosing. That continuous assessment is hallmark nursing care.
Okay, that makes sense. Now, this brings us to another extremely important area for patient safety, critical drug interactions. What else should patients absolutely avoid when taking benzodiazepines? Because we know interactions can turn a therapeutic drug into a dangerous one, often without the patient even realizing the risk.
This is an area where comprehensive, clear, emphatic patient education from you is absolutely non-negotiable. The primary substances to avoid are those that also depress the CNS, because the combined effect is synergistic and dangerous. First and foremost, alcohol. Significantly enhances CNS depression. It's a potent additive effect leading to severe sedation, respiratory depression, coma, death far more rapidly and severely than either alone. There is no safe amount of alcohol with these meds.
No alcohol, period. Got it. What else?
Beyond alcohol, other CNS depressant drugs. This includes opioid analgesics. Their combined effect is so dangerous, the FDA has issued black box warnings on both, urging extreme caution, often recommending against co-prescription due to the risk of respiratory depression and death. You also need to educate patients about common over-the-counter OTC medications many don't realize are CNS depressants. This includes antihistamines, think diphenhydramine, and Benadryl, or combo cold flu remedies.
Right, things people take for allergies or sleep without thinking twice.
Exactly. Also, many OTC sleeping pills like Tylenol PM, Compos, Nitol, Somanex, Unisom often contain antihistamines or other sedating agents. Patients see them as harmless, but they significantly add to CNS depression when taken with benzos, drastically increasing risk.
That's a huge potential blind spot for patients, not realizing these readily available OTC drugs can be so dangerous with their prescription. Puts a lot of responsibility on the nurse for thorough education, maybe even asking to see all their medications.
It absolutely does. And having patients bring in all their meds, including OTCs and supplements, for reconciliation is best practice. Furthermore, certain sedating herbs should also be avoided. Kava, valerian, melatonin. Perceived as natural, but they also possess CNS depressant properties that add to the benzo effects.
kava, valerian, melatonin.
Okay. Beyond interactions, our sources also specifically mention important contraindications for diazepam, Valium, which often apply broadly to many benzos due to shared properties. These include severe respiratory disorders, as the drug can worsen breathing, severe liver and kidney disease due to impaired metabolism and excretion leading to accumulation, hypersensitivity reactions, rare but serious allergy, and a history of alcohol or other drug abuse due to increased risk of dependence and misuse. Crucially, benzos are contraindicated in pregnancy and breastfeeding. They cross the placenta and breast milk.
Okay, definitely not for pregnancy or breastfeeding. What can happen?
Potential fetal harm, like floppy infant syndrome, hypotonia, lethargy, poor sucking, respiratory depression if used near term, or sedation and poor feeding in the nursing infant. The risks usually outweigh benefits, requiring alternative strategies.
This entire section on interactions and contraindications is paramount for patient education and safety checks during medication administration for any nursing student. You are, in many ways, the last line of defense before that pill is swallowed.
Absolutely. You're not just administering, you're verifying, educating, advocating. You provide detailed, clear education, emphasizing these risks. Before giving any benzo, a thorough med reconciliation and history are essential. Your vigilance directly impacts safety, prevents serious adverse events, and empowers patients. Shifting our focus now, if we connect this to the bigger picture, it's clear medication isn't one size fits all. Our sources highlight several special populations needing particular caution with benzodiazepines, demanding highly individualized nursing care, not just adjusting dose, but understanding physiological differences.
It really emphasizes that person-centered care approach, doesn't it? What works safely for one patient might be dangerous for another, especially with different ages or unique physiological states.
Exactly. Let's start with children. Caution is paramount. A unique, critical concern is that children, especially younger ones, may experience paradoxical CNS stimulation and excitement instead of sedation.
Right, the agitation instead of calm.
Yes. Agitation, hyperactivity, insomnia, even aggression. Completely reverses the desired effect, alarming if you're unaware. Close monitoring for these unexpected responses is critical. Benzos are used very cautiously in pediatrics. Next, older adults, who we've discussed extensively, require exceptional vigilance. They metabolize benzos more slowly due to age-related liver changes.
Slower metabolism, higher risk of accumulation.
Right. Increased risk for accumulating the drug and its active metabolites, especially with long-acting benzos, half-lives 24 hours. This leads to exaggerated sedation, confusion, cognitive impairment, and that substantially heightened fall risk. For you, this means meticulous dose adjustment starting low, maybe half or quarter dose, and continuous vigilant monitoring for changes in mental status, gait, balance. Checking the Beers criteria is also key.
So for older adults, it's not just slower metabolism, but those breakdown products, the active metabolites, linger and continue pausing effects, essentially a prolonged drug exposure, increasing risk.
Precisely. A compounding effect, a double burden. They're already at higher fall risk, and adding an accumulating sedative can be devastating. Next, individuals with renal or hepatic impairment also require extreme caution. Liver metabolizes, kidneys excrete.
Yeah.
If either organ isn't optimal, the drug and metabolites aren't cleared effectively.
Leading to accumulation and toxicity again.
Correct. Increased risk of accumulation and severe adverse effects. As a nurse, you'll monitor liver labs, ALT, AST, bilirubin, and kidney labs, BUN, creatinine, GFR, closely, advocating for dose adjustments based on these vital signs. Finally, pregnant and breastfeeding individuals should generally avoid benzos entirely. They cross the placenta and into breast milk.
Affecting the fetus or infant?
Yes. Yeah. Potential congenital malformations, first trimester, floppy infant syndrome, late pregnancy, or sedation poor, feeding in nursing infants. Risks typically outweigh benefits, necessitating safer alternatives.
Okay, let's take a moment now to really cement our understanding by looking at diazepam Valium, which our sources present as a prototype. It's an excellent way to tie all these intricate considerations together, see them in a practical context.
It truly is an excellent example, bringing the theoretical into practice. As a prototype, diazepam perfectly illustrates the key characteristics. Reviewing its mechanism enhances GABA's inhibitory effect.
The brake pedal enhancer.
Right. Potentiating the brain's brake leads to its wide range of uses. Anxiety relief, tension reduction, sleep promotion, muscle relaxation, anticonvulsant effects. Think broad CNS depressant, calming mind and body multiple ways.
And its uses really span critical scenarios beyond just daily anxiety, right? Like we covered.
Reviewing its indications.
Yeah.
General anti-anxiety, hypnotic, anticonvulsant, also preoperative sedation, anxiety reduction, amnesia. vital role in acute alcohol withdrawal, agitation, DTs, and treating anxiety with depression, psychosis, mania, adjunct therapy bridge, administered PO, IM, or 5E, offering flexibility.
So what are the absolute critical cautions and considerations to remember with diazepam, specifically for you as nurses, when thinking about patient safety and individualized care? What are the big takeaways?
This is where your advocacy and vigilance sharpen for children. Caution about paradoxical CNS stimulation for older adults. Exaggerated sedation, high fall risk, slow metabolism accumulation, needing meticulous dose adjustment. For renal hepatic impairment, risk of accumulation adverse effects, needing close organ function monitoring. In critical care, extreme caution combining with other CNS depressants. Beyond populations, remember its long half-life, 20-80 hours. Liver metabolism, kidney excretion, influencing dosing, accumulation, monitoring. It's Schedule 4, potential for dependence, mandating gradual tapering. And crucial contraindications, severe respiratory, liver, kidney disorders, hypersensitivity, substance abuse history, pregnancy, breastfeeding. Reviewing diazepam consolidates these details you'll actively apply daily. This leads us to a crucial consideration for every nursing student. What is the comprehensive patient education you must provide when a patient starts benzodiazepine therapy? This isn't just a quick chat. It's a cornerstone of safe medication management and truly empowers your patient.
Because without that clear, thorough, unambiguous education, patients can inadvertently put themselves at serious, even life-threatening risk, even with the best intentions.
Right.
They simply don't know what they don't know.
Exactly. Your role in patient teaching is absolutely critical. The core elements you must cover are expansive. First, instruct patients to avoid alcohol completely. Non-negotiable, due to profound additive CNS depression risk. Similarly, avoid other depressant drugs and be specific. OTC antihistamines like diphenhydramine, Benadryl, many OTC sleeping pills, Tylenol PM, etc. Emphasize these seemingly innocuous drugs contain sedating ingredients that compound effects. Avoid narcotic analgesics, opioids, unless prescribed with full knowledge and caution.
So it's about making them aware of these hidden depressants they might not even think about, but which pose a significant risk. Maybe even ask them to bring in all their bottles to review.
Absolutely. Medication reconciliation is key. Also advise against sedating herbs, kava, valerian, melatonin. They can contribute to CNS depression. Another absolutely crucial piece, do not abruptly stop the medication. Emphasize gradual tapering to avoid severe withdrawal. Explain physiological dependence, that sudden cessation causes distressing, even dangerous symptoms like seizures. Never alter dose or stop without consulting their provider. Discuss potential adverse effects, primarily sedation, drowsiness, dizziness. Advise extreme caution with driving, operating machinery, critical decisions until they know how it affects them. Encourage reporting unusual side effects, paradoxical agitation, mood changes, immediately.
And taking the medication exactly as prescribed, not altering doses, is probably key to avoiding all these complications. It sounds like a lot for a patient to absorb, though.
It is a lot, which is why your clear communication, plain language, and written instructions are vital. Explain the importance of taking it exactly as directed, clarifying dosing, timing, especially if intermittent for insomnia. You're not just relaying info. You're teaching them how to safely manage a powerful drug. Providing this clear, concise, thorough education empowers the patient as an active participant. It's a cornerstone of safe management, adherence, minimizing risks, better outcomes. You're giving them the knowledge and tools to use it safely, a profound responsibility.
We've covered a tremendous amount in this deep dive into drug therapy for anxiety and insomnia. From the nuanced, sometimes beneficial role of anxiety itself, to the intricate mechanisms of benzodiazepines, and critically, to the vital safety considerations for patients across different populations. You, the nursing student, have now navigated the distinctions between anxiolytics and hypnotics, understood how GABA's brake pedal function is enhanced, providing that crucial safety ceiling, and explored the complex journey these drugs take through the body metabolism, excretion challenges. We've dissected meticulous dosing guidelines, recognized dangers of withdrawal and toxicity, armed you with knowledge of critical drug interactions, and identified unique needs of special, vulnerable populations.
This raises an important question for you as a future nurse. How will you leverage this comprehensive understanding, not just to administer medication, but to become a true advocate for your patients? Beyond simply knowing the what of these drugs, reflect on the how you will ethically and skillfully educate, meticulously monitor, and critically think about each individual patient's unique needs, vulnerabilities, and physiological responses. Your vigilance and nuanced understanding are paramount to ensuring their safety and well-being in a world grappling with the pervasive challenges of anxiety and insomnia.
And that's our deep dive for today. We hope you feel significantly more informed, more confident, and truly ready to apply this crucial knowledge in your practice. Keep learning, keep asking those insightful questions, and we'll see you on the next deep dive.